Good morning. You have tuned into the morning show here on 88.5 KRFY. This is Panhandle Community Radio. Thursday, February 19th. I'm Jack Peterson. I'm here with Jim Healy. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Jack. And we're not alone. We have Patty Erickson and Preston Andrews from the Kinnickinnick Native Plant Society with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
And I just want to say that all three of our jaws dropped when you came up the steps with your bicycle this morning that you pedaled in.
I did. Well, I had to test, you know, test myself and test the test that mean street machine that I ride in on so often.
Did you? How was it?
It was not bad.
I mean, you
it's
don't
not
have
coming down.
You don't have fat bulbous tires. You have the teeny weeny ones.
That's right. It's sort of like figure skating probably. But as long as I go in a straight line, you know, then it's fine. Ooh. It's when I try to make a sharp turn that things get a little dicey. But no, it was fine. Now, yesterday I did drive. I took a car.
Okay.
Yesterday.
Understood.
As it was kind
understood.
Of the you know, when it was actually coming down out of the sky. But this morning I could have gone either way, and I thought it's so nice out. The sky was blue, it was bright. I put on my sunglasses and I pedaled in. And I don't think I can say I regretted it. I don't know if I'm there was a time about a couple blocks from home that I thought, well, maybe this wasn't the best idea, but I was committed by that point. So, anyway,
we are happy you made it here safe and sound.
Yeah. I did. I'm here. It's nice and toasty warm in the studio. It is bright outside, or it was this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Finally
mm-hmm.
having that snow on the ground. It seems like we've been waking up all these for this
spring.
Whole winter.
It's been spring.
It's been spring, and it's been like gray, gloomy kind of weather. And now a bright white winter morning has finally arrived.
Well, we need to get moving on our interviews after we do weather because Preston is here in his ski clothes and he is sweating and he's anxious to get up on the mountain, right?
Absolutely. Yes, okay. Should be good today.
We're talking with the Kinnickinnick Native Plant Society and then also a little later on in the hour, an interview with Caden and Rylan Butera, who are the filmmakers of the movie Recollection that'll be showing at the Panada tonight.
Mm-hmm. You bet. How about the weather? Let's do the weather and let's let Preston know what he's going to find up on the mountain.
Okay. We are, tracking areas of winter weather, severe weather, and even fire weather. How about that?
Fire? F-I-R-E?
I don't think that's really in our area, but elsewhere in the nation, there's fire concerns with the gusty winds going on. Today, though, here.
Not here.
Let's talk about here. Let's talk about our area. Today, a 20% chance of precipitation increasing to 50%, and that will be snow. That will not be rain. That'll be down as snow.
Ooh.
The high is 33. Snow likely overnight with a overnight low of 19 degrees. A 32-degree high tomorrow and 40% chance of more snow. And then looks like kind of clearing up. On Saturday, partly sunny and a high of 39, a slight chance of snow on Sunday as well. And then it looks like maybe it's going to warm up next week, highs in the low 40s, and that means some of this snow could shift into some more of that lovely rain that we've enjoyed these past couple months.
I do want to comment on your the weather phrasing of slight chance. What's the difference between slight chance and chance? Just asking.
It's a percentage, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm marveled by it. But we've got guests in the studio. But before I get too far into the Kinnickinnick Native Plant Society, I do want to draw attention to how wonderful the Little Live Radio Hour last Tuesday evening with Justin Landis and with Josh Hedlund at the Hive. That was wonderful hour of music, acoustic music that was just perfect.
They did a great job.
They did.
Yep. Little Wolf.
And we have moved over to the Hive and the next one, everyone, and it's free. That's the marvelous thing about the Little Live Radio Hour. It'll be St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, the Tuesday, and we're going to have local Celtic musicians and singers.
Mm-hmm. Assembling a group. Hopefully, okay. Yeah, I don't want to name any names just yet until I have people confirmed, but
I'll be there. You can name my name.
Well, Jim Healy will be there.
Yes,
put a face to the voice.
Okay, and Kinnickinnick Native Plant Society, we have the president with us, Preston Andrews, and Patty is never to be president, correct?
Yes.
Okay, real briefly, talk about the society, and then we have a grant we want to talk about, and about some of the upcoming programs.
Okay. We were founded in 1997, and it was led by Lois Wythe, did many other things in this community. And we there was about 60 members at that time. We're just over 100.
Okay.
So we stay pretty steady membership-wise. In 2 years later, we founded the Arboretum in Lakeview Park.
Okay.
In Arbor Day of 2001, mm-hmm. and 1999, and we celebrated our 25th anniversary 2 years ago, and we're moving ahead with improvements there.
Excellent, excellent. Now, the grant we're going to talk about is named after the founder.
That's right.
Of the Plant Society. So let's talk about the grant. Then I want to get back and find out what a native plant is.
Okay. Well, the Lois Wythe Grant has been going on for a couple decades, and it goes to an organization, a person, a group of people who are willing to do a project that encourages our mission, which is to educate and conserve and propagate native plants in this area. And it is a Bonner County-only grant.
Oh, okay.
It has a limitation of that. It's called the Lois Wythe Grant. And it's $500, which is not a huge amount of money, but it can do good.
Mm-hmm.
Recent people, organizations who've received it, going back a few years, we had a grad student from University of Idaho who was doing a floristic survey of the North Idaho.
Hmm.
And she hired an artist to draw pictures of the plants she found. And she also found a rare plant. Which we can talk about if you want, but let me finish about the grant itself.
Okay, you bet.
We did the book, The Busy Bombus Bee.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Mm-hmm. We had them on the air.
Yes, me and Hannah.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And then we've funded signs for the Rewild Project out at Kootenai School that KLT has done.
Mm-hmm.
Last year we did the Sandpoint Organic Ag Center is planting a native plant garden, and the grant went to them for buying plants for their native plant garden. So those are a few of the recent applicants that were successful.
How does one go about to apply for the grant?
One goes to the website of nativeplant.org.
Nativeplantsociety.org.
Oh, society. Thank you.
The president knows that.
He does, even though I'm in charge of the website.
Nativeplantsociety.org.
Right. If you just look up Sandpoint Native Plant Society, it pops up.
Okay.
And in that, there's a tab on what we do, and Lois Wythe Grant is right there, and it's a fillable form right online.
Cool.
It's very simple.
Okay.
And includes things like what's a paragraph about your project and who will it impact and how will you sustain this project after the grant and a budget. And it's not at all complicated. And then you click send.
Ooh, what a concept.
Okay.
Yeah. And it goes directly into the KNPS email, and that has to be done by March 31st.
Okay. The deadline is, well, there's a little bit of a month and a half. Month and a week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's plenty of time.
Okay.
You get your thoughts together, sit down for an hour, and you can write this grant.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not a difficult grant to write.
It doesn't sound like the process is that difficult.
It's very short and
good.
And we have a team of six people from the Native Plant Society who look at the grants and say, hey, this one works, this one doesn't work, and assesses the appropriateness of the grant and ranks them. And
now, one more time, with Native Plant or Plants Society? Is the plant?
It's Native Plant Society.
One plant.
One plant.
Yeah. One plant. Just want to make sure. Okay, we'll come back to the Lewis White grant. Deadline is the last day of March. Let's talk native plants. Okay. What's a native plant?
I'll give you a simple definition.
Go for it.
It's a plant that occurs naturally in an area. Now, I've looked for definitions from all the authoritative sources, mm-hmm. and no two match. So you could say a plant that occurs here without human interference. In other words, it wasn't brought here by humans. It didn't escape or wasn't caused by breeding of a new variety. But there are plants that become naturalized that weren't native. They adapt to the site, and some of them are invasive and become weeds.
Okay.
And some of them are noxious weeds, and the state then regulates how those are taken care of, managed. Okay. Some people say before Lewis and Clark arrived, the plants that were here before they arrived, of course, they didn't arrive in Bonner County.
Right.
They were
right.
further south. So it's a little slippery.
Okay. I'd like to ask, Patty, you mentioned a previous grant winner, a rare plant. What that intrigues me.
It was really cool, but I don't know enough about the name, et cetera, and I'm going to turn it back to Preston.
And I don't remember the name of the plant itself.
It was a moonwort.
Oh, it was a moonwort. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a fern. It was found way up by the Canadian border, over above Upper Priest Lake. And we actually went out there and found it, a group of us, and found some of those growing.
This is after Harpo had actually found it.
Absolutely, yeah. This was after it had been discovered by the grad student from U of I. And so a rare plant is a plant that is rare, unusual, is not commonly found. And the Idaho Native Plant Society has a rare plant working group, and they keep track of rare plants in Idaho. And every year they have a session or a conference on rare plants and which one should be called rare. And they don't have federal protection necessarily. Some do, like the white bark pine would, but not all rare plants that Native Plant Societies would call rare would get federal protection.
So there's
or state protection.
Lots of rare plants out there?
There are quite a few. I don't know the number that the Idaho Native Plant Society has identified. It may be, it's definitely in, less than maybe 100 or so.
One of our goals as a Native Plant Society is conservation of native plants. And with this particular moonwort, we ran into a situation where we did try to advocate for its conservation because there was going to be a road built where it was.
Mm. And how did that unfold?
Well, they built the road, and
it was for border enforcement.
Border enforcement.
Okay, I'm just sort of curious about a moonwort.
Me too. Yeah.
When you say you found moonwort, was that a clump of them, or was it just one little moonwort? Or, you see what I'm getting at? When I think of a rare plant, I think it's like hiding out there and it's by itself. And
there were a number of individuals.
Okay.
And it was found in several places, but it had never been found in Idaho before.
Oh.
So it was a new plant for Idaho, even though it probably has been there, and it probably came across from Canada. It probably.
Okay. I'm
not sure about that, but plants move around and they don't respect borders that we draw.
Okay.
Hmm. So would you consider that a native plant? Is that considered a native plant?
That would be considered a native plant.
Okay.
Right.
Because, yeah, nobody planted it. No,
right.
No human
right.
being came.
Even if we haven't found it, if it's been there and we finally discover it, then it's still a native plant.
Okay. Do you have any controversial opinions on what constitutes a native plant? Any place where you disagree with some of the definitions?
I would say, I think they all have good general definitions. I don't think there's anything that, because we're talking about, you know, wildlife society and various governmental organizations, but I don't really have anything. You know, I think pinning it on certain explorers' presence is maybe not the right way to frame a native plant.
Mm-hmm. One of the things,
because Native Americans they cultivated native plants for their food sources and other uses.
One of the things that you get into kind of dicey territory with are nativars. Yes, nativars.
Oh, now we're going into deep.
now we're getting into the deep doo doo.
The deep state of native plants.
Nativars.
Okay, if you have a native plant and then you start breeding native plants together, and then you release it as a variety, a named variety, then it's called a nativar. And there's a lot of dispute whether that should be considered native or not.
Does nature naturally create nativars? I guess what I'm thinking of is, you know, I'm an elk. I eat something over here, I eat something there, and I poop it out, and boom-o, I have a new creation.
Some plants cross.
Does it work like that?
Some plants cross-pollinate.
Yeah.
And some plants don't.
Ah, okay.
They self-pollinate. Mm-hmm. And so cross-pollination genes would be exchanged between different types, maybe.
Via bees would.
The bees would move the pollen around.
But the ones, are there plants that say, ugh, get away, I don't want to pollinate. You know, I mean, I just.
They don't survive.
okay.
There's also native plants that not just interpollinate or whatever you'd call it with other native plants, they interpollinate with cultivated plants. And we had a blanket flower kerfuffle not long ago about, you know, what is this blanket flower really a native, or is it a nativar, is it a cultivar, is it, what the heck is this particular plant? And it's hard.
What's a cultivar? Nativar, I got. What's a cultivar?
A cultivar is just a plant that's been
intentionally?
Intentionally bred.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
Like all our roses.
Okay.
Are
okay.
Cultivars.
Cultivars.
Yeah.
So there is
tomatoes.
It seems like it. Yeah. Does anybody ever come in with like a palm tree and say, I'm pretty sure this is native. Can you verify? No.
No,
that doesn't happen.
Not yet.
Okay.
That would be fun.
No. But is there anything where you are kind of like, oh, this is ridiculous? No, this is not a native plant.
Well, the universities, the University of Washington, University of Idaho, have herbaria, botanists have collected plants and brought them in, and they've preserved them, pressed them, dried them, preserved them. And they have records of what's been found and what's not been found and what they look like. So botanists consult those herbaria specimens.
Interesting.
For validity of.
Okay.
And now they can do DNA testing and lots of sophisticated things, not just looking at leaf structure and petals and stuff like that. There's more.
So my precious huckleberries are native plants?
Ooh.
The
huckleberries?
Huckleberries are native.
Are native? Okay,
they are.
Good.
Yes.
Oh, yes. I just want to make sure that when I'm picking them, that I'm participating in a native.
Yeah.
Definitely native.
Are there any plants that are widespread that are people would think of as native but are not?
Ooh.
Dandelions. That was a joke.
I can't pull one off the top of my head on that. But
okay,
would dandelions be considered a native plant?
No.
Yeah. But they sure like it.
Yeah.
Oh, so why do I have them then?
Right. Yeah. Why not?
Because they're adapted to grow here, and some. I think they're a European. And so they got here like many other things got here through human transport.
At one time, Idaho did not have dandelions?
Right.
What a concept.
Came on the bottom of somebody's shoe.
Yeah.
Well.
Or a hoof of a elk.
Yeah. We're talking to Patty Erickson and Preston Andrews from the Kinnickinnick Native Plant Society about native plants. And the society, the work of the society is to do, we know, it's to promote knowledge of native plants. What kind of day-to-day things are you up to? Your people come to you and ask you questions, and you're the local authority.
Well, right now, I can just, Preston can pick up on the programs that we do.
Right, yeah. Right.
But really quickly, we are in the process of a big upgrade at the Arboretum. We got a grant from the Equinox Foundation.
Ah.
And we're doing all new signage and plant signs, entry signs, youth-oriented signs, and eventually an audio tour. So we're in the midst of a whole lot of work that's very educationally oriented.
Cool.
So it'll really brighten up the user experience when you come to the Arboretum and want to learn things.
Is there a time frame for that?
It has to be done by August. Yes. Okay. We're under the crunch. We've got a local artist who's working with us. Randy Wilhelm is working with us to do some of the designs and committees for the youth signs, committees for the kiosk, committees for the plant signs, and unfortunately, that's my job, is to corral those people.
Okay. Preston, upcoming programs.
And we are a 100% volunteer organization.
There you go.
We do hire a summer arboretum coordinator.
Sure.
And but otherwise, we're all putting in our time for the good of the cause. But programs, we have nine programs a year. We have six in the winter and spring, and then we have three in the fall. So we skip July, August, and December because people are away mostly then. Our programs coming up in the next – oh, I brought the wrong thing here. Okay. Rachel Mallison – Dr. Rachel Mallison from the University of Montana, from the Flathead Lake Biostation, will be talking about her work organizing volunteers to monitor water quality in the upper Clark Fork, Columbia River watershed. Of course, this impacts us because the Clark Fork flows into Lake Ponderé.
Sure.
So she's going to be talking to us via Zoom on Saturday morning, starting at 10 o'clock at the large meeting room in the library.
Saturday, this Saturday?
The 21st.
Oh, like close.
And, just a tidbit, Rachel grew up on Renko Loop.
Oh, yeah, she's a local.
She's a local.
Yeah.
Okay, so what time in the library?
10 a.m. is when the program actually starts. We have coffee, tea, treats at 9:30 and social time. Okay. For half an hour.
Okay,
so she won't be coming here from...
it'll be a Zoom.
She'll be sending her presentation via Zoom. In March, we are going to have Jennifer Ekstrom from the Idaho Conservation League. She's the North Idaho director of the ICL.
Mm-hmm.
And she's going to be talking about water and the... ICL's Northern Lakes and Waters programs. So they do water quality monitoring here around Lake Ponderé, and they do, they deal with the Trestle Creek development issues, the mines from Canada that selenium is coming down the Kootenay River. So they're dealing with a lot of conservation things. But they have a program in which volunteers, and we've been volunteers for 8 or so years, go out and collect water samples.
Ooh.
In the lake,
okay,
in our kayaks or in a boat, and then bring them back, and then they're analyzed in the Idaho Department of, I better not say which Idaho Department, because I forget which one.
Natural Resources.
No, I don't think it's Natural Resources, but anyway. They analyze it and decide whether there needs to be some mitigation done.
Sure, sure. Now, this is in March?
This will be March 21st as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. This is February is the same as March this
year. Yeah.
So the 21st in the library?
Yes.
At 10 o'clock?
At 10 a.m. And it will. Okay. Jennifer will be live in the presenting.
Of course.
And do you want to talk about April? Just mention April?
April come May.
April, mm-hmm. I don't know the date on that one, but it's going to be a member or a couple members from the Coeur d'Alene tribe coming to talk about their natural resource programs. That they,
cool.
Yeah, so that's going to be
exciting. Again in the library. It'll
be in the library again.
So one can go to nativeplantsociety.org and find all of these programs.
Under the events tab.
Events tab. Good, good, good. Okay. Busy.
Busy indeed.
Busy people.
And then we have more education programs coming up in the spring.
Okay.
We host tree tours for third grade students from Lake Pend'Oreille School District, from the various elementary schools, and they come to the Arboretum, and we talk about the various trees that grow in North Idaho.
And it's about 250 kids.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I'm sure with a bunch of questions, you know, I mean, just...
And short attention spans.
Oh, I can relate to that.
Yeah.
Going back to native plants, are fungi considered native plants?
Well, fungi aren't categorized as plants. They're in their own separate
universe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fungi. But they're native, of course.
But why wouldn't they be? Now, this shows my ignorance about botany. Why wouldn't they be considered plants?
Well, I've plant science background, but I'm not a plant, what they call a plant taxonomist or that divides up the you know, what to call mm-hmm. things and mm-hmm. What mm-hmm. place to put them. So I just accept what the plant taxonomists have defined the various parts of the plant kingdom.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Mushrooms are not.
Outside the kingdom.
Well, yeah. When I go out picking huckleberries, I see mushrooms everywhere. And I wonder, you know, like, are they mm-hmm. plants or how did they get here? And magic.
Well, many people do consider them like plants, plant-like.
Okay,
so,
yeah, I figure. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, the tough question that Jack and I have been holding back on. Oh, mm-hmm. What is your favorite native plant? Favorite, you know, that mm-hmm. come hell or high water, nothing else in your yard or garden, but boom.
Well, I answered this last time I was here.
I know, but we forgot.
I didn't.
Oh, good.
Thank goodness. That gives him a chance to think. I have really fallen in love with milkweed, the showy milkweed that is native here, and it has the most fabulous blooms, and all of the pollinators love it. And if we get, by some rare happenstance, a monarch to come through.
I was going
to
say monarchs.
Yeah,
love
but
milkweed.
they're not very common here, to okay. say the least. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't. It's not only for the monarchs. It's mm-hmm. for, they're big and tall and beautiful, and they go through the stages where they're these gorgeous, you know, the size of a fist, mm-hmm. easily blooming with all kinds of small blooms in between, and
right.
they're pink, and they're beautiful, and then they turn into these wonderful pods, and all this crazy silk comes out of them, and they're just really gorgeous, and they grow like weeds. They've grown into... From where we planted them, they've grown into our gravel driveway.
Cool, cool.
And they just keep popping up all over the place. So.
And they're low maintenance or
pretty
no
much
maintenance.
No, we watered them to start with. And then the first year after we had planted them, I went out there and I kept looking for them and looking for them. And they weren't there. And I was like, oh, they all died. And what are we going to do? But they stay in the ground till they're sure it's warm enough.
They're good and ready.
They're really careful. And then all of a sudden, you'll see the little sprouts coming up.
And it works.
You're like, oh, whew.
So Patty votes for milkweed. Preston?
Well, as a plant person, I have so many favorites. So, but I'm gonna have to pick today, this morning.
Desert Island.
This morning.
The one that you're gonna take with you.
I'm gonna say the Western Red Cedar. I love trees, and the Western Red Cedar is one of the most beautiful trees. It's so useful. It's so magnificent,
Western Red Cedar.
The Western Red Cedar is a if you've been to. The grove over in Montana.
The Cedar Grove.
Ross Creek Cedars.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or there's other groves around too.
Don't we have a grove in the Arboretum?
And we have many cedars in the arboretum as well. Okay. But the thing about Western Red Cedars is they define our area as having as being part of what's called the inland temperate rainforest, which is the largest inland rainforest in the temperate zone in the world.
Okay.
Here, and, right
and,
here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and the plants that define it are the Western Red Cedar and the Western Hemlock, which are mostly coastal species, but somehow post-glaciation arrived here. And from all the way from the Clearwater, northern slopes of the Clearwater River, up through middle part of Canada, on the west side of the Rockies, is pockets of this rainforest. And so if you go out and you see a cedar grove, you know you're kind of in a very wet and rainforesty kind of habitat.
But wouldn't a Western Red Cedar be a tree?
It is a tree.
It is a tree. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, but I asked you for a plant.
Well, it's a plant too. Sorry.
I'm so confused.
I looked at my computer here, Jim.
Yeah.
Okay. Trees are plants, yes. A mushroom, a fungus, not a plant. And I'll tell you the difference. Plants photosynthesize, meaning they sun shines on a plant and a plant grows. Mushroom does not. Mushroom eats what's in the ground, does not require the sun whatsoever.
You're getting techie on me.
That's true.
I mean.
Let's see. They also, they acquire their food by absorbing dissolved organic molecules, typically by secreting digestive enzymes into their environment. So they're similar to animals in that way as far as where mushrooms get their food. Yes. So you do find them around plants because they're eating.
They're
plants.
Eating off them.
Yeah.
This makes me kind of wish that I took botany in high school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't. I took chemistry. And you know, hearing about plants and trees and mushrooms.
Well, an interesting thing in our backyard, we planted a Western Red Cedar because we plant lots of native plants. And instead of training it to a single trunk like most trees are, I just kind of let it send out as many shoots, branches as possible.
Yeah.
And it's created this dense bush. It's maybe
gigantic.
Maybe about 12 feet wide. And
at least 12 feet wide, maybe 14 feet wide.
And it is habitat for all the native birds. They go in the inside of that, and they hang out, and they're protected from the elements and protected from predation from neighborhood cats. You know, so I've discovered it doesn't look like a typical cedar tree.
It's gorgeous. How tall is it? 20 feet tall?
Oh, wow.
Something like that.
Good. It's a monster of a thing. And then you hear all these birds. I mean, it's just crazy. You hear all these birds and you can't see them. And then you stare at this giant Western Red Cedar and you realize it's alive.
It's
fluttering
with birds.
It's
cool.
And they're going in and out to the bird feeders and they're just happy,
happy
as they can be.
Western cedars, when you mention, you know, groves, they're the tall, straight ones going straight up. Okay, now, why in nature? You said you let it go. You didn't make it go. Does nature prune out? How does that work? I'm sorry. Do you see what I'm asking?
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. And I would like to hear the answer.
That's a good question. I expected this cedar in our yard to grow a single trunk. So
it surprised me
when it sent out all of these other
little things,
little trunks, basically. I haven't counted how many are in there. There might be four, five, six.
And so
it'll be a bush. It'll always be a bush.
It'll never grow like as tall as Western Red Cedars?
No. But we kind of like it this way.
Well, heck yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's fabulous.
You bet.
But if you go in Lakeview Park and you look at the Western Red Cedars, you'll see they're a single trunk.
Right.
And they're tall.
Right.
And majestic looking trees. And that's typically what you'll find.
So did you have any idea when you planted that Red Cedar that this is what would happen?
I didn't.
No.
No. We were just like, oh, that's
and
interesting.
And then we just kind of let it be.
That's cool.
And people come over and they say, what is that?
Yeah.
It's a Western Red Cedar. And
oh,
they're
it
like,
can't
no,
be. No
can't
way.
Be.
Yeah. Oh, superb.
It's
we're here with Preston Andrews and Patricia Patty Erickson, and we're talking Kinnickinnick Native Plant Society. And one more time, we have the Lois Wythe Grant.
Yes.
That applications can be found on Native Plant, One Plant Society.org. And the deadline is the 31st, the last day of March.
Yes, 31st.
31st, mm-hmm. last day of March.
Yeah.
Anything else that we can?
We just come out to our program on Saturday morning at the library if you're interested in water and water quality and how volunteers can contribute to keeping our environment and waterways
I'll put in
pure.
A plug for our education committee. If you have any interest in helping out with the tree tours, it is a huge project. Well, you have over 200 children who come, and it has to be highly organized, highly...
Sure.
Yes. So we are really in need of volunteers. And
how does one go about volunteering?
That can't be a stick.
He's whispering to me.
Whispering. We picked that up on our
headphones. You did pick that up on your headphones.
Would you like me to turn off the mic for a second?
No. Okay. KNPS.tech. KNPS.tech at gmail.com.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay. All right,
and I mean, you can go to our website. There's lots of ways to contact us. Every contact form goes to somebody in the organization who knows what's going on. In fact, there is an education tab on the website, and that'll directly to the person who is doing this. But there's lots of ways to get to us on that website. It definitely would work. We really do need volunteers.
I would imagine with 250 kids, third graders, they'd go into 250 different directions. And
it does happen over 3 days. So we do divide it up because we couldn't handle all of them at once.
Mm-hmm.
We're working in concert with the museum, too. They will be having things going on at the same time.
Mm-hmm. I am going to ask you, of course, we'll have both of you on again. I want a picture of your western red cedar as a bush.
Okay.
Okay, and then
we'll have one of us standing in front of it too to get a
perspective
on size.
Yeah, and then we can hold up to the mic and share it with our listeners.
Yeah.
The arboretum can be visited year round.
Year round. Okay. 24 hours a day. Not much to see in the dark.
It's in Lakeview Park, I guess next to Lakeview Park.
It's sandwiched between the museum and the water sewer treatment plant.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Perfect place.
Patty, Preston, thank you guys so much for coming in. And Preston, you have a good day up on the mountain.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Patty, you have a good day not up on the mountain.
That's right. I'll be doing my fun stuff.
Okay. We're going to take a music break, and then we're going to go over to... the film tonight at the Panetta Theater. This song became very important, and in 1981, it was settled. The lawsuit over George Harrison's My Sweet Lord was settled to the tune of $587,000 for the Chiffons' He's So Fine. And you know, for somebody who loves music like me, I can listen to He's So Fine, and then I go to My Sweet Lord, and I don't see or hear. Mm-hmm. But music people do. So here's George Harrison, My Sweet Lord, here on 88.5 KRFY. Thanks so much again for coming in.
Okay, Jack Peterson here. I'm now in the studio with Rylan and Caden Butera, who are filmmakers behind the new movie, Recollection, which is showing at the Panetta Theater. And when you're listening to this, it's showing tonight. This is a pre-recording, but it's showing on February 19th at the Panetta Theater. And are you both going to be there, actually, at the theater as well?
Absolutely. We're going to be there. Some of the cast and some of the crew are going to be there. All the local people who shot this movie.
Okay, cool. So there will be a little Q&A, I think, if I read correctly in the newspaper. Q&A starts at 6, and then followed by the movie?
I believe it's...
You can correct me if I'm
wrong. It could be the opposite. I know the movie at least starts at 7.
Show the movie first and then do a Q&A after.
Yeah, I believe that's what we're doing.
That makes more sense to me. Okay, so for those who are not familiar at all with this, with the film, it's called Recollection, and I guess, tell us the story and maybe your intended audience.
Sure. So Recollection, it's a sci-fi thriller and it's a feature film. So it's a full hour and 58 minute movie.
Okay.
And we shot it all in Coeur d'Alene and Sandpoint and Ponderay and a little bit in Washington, with all local people. So it takes place in a dystopia where you have the technology to delete memories from your mind, traumatic memories, mildly inconvenient memories, anything you don't want, you go and delete. And we follow a character who does this all the time until one day she receives all of her old memories back in a glitch and kind of uncovers a conspiracy within the memory deleting company, finds out she had a family that she didn't even know she had, and kind of uncovers this conspiracy as we get to the bottom of the mystery.
Mm-hmm. Caden, you're the director of the film?
Yes, I'm the director and then the co-writer, and my brother to my left over here.
Yeah, so we wrote the story together, so I'm the other co-writer, and then I wrote the music for it, so I'm the composer for the project.
Cool. Was that, I just watched the trailer. You can find it online as well. It's trailer's on YouTube. Mm-hmm. So was that your music that I heard?
It was, yeah.
Very nice.
Thank you.
All I really knew about this movie before watching that trailer is that it was a sci-fi movie and filmed sort of around here. Mm-hmm. Having now seen that and seen a couple of pictures in the in this week's paper, or rather, I guess last week's paper, it looks incredible, and I'm struggling to identify where you could have found some of those places to take those shots. It looks...
Thank you.
I'm like, where is that? I didn't see anything that I recognized.
Yeah, I mean, it's we definitely went for a more stylized look in this film, as in hyper stylized lighting, a harder, more stylized color grade. So we kind of transformed places that you may very much recognize into a more dystopian looking place. And so we shot everywhere from at the lighthouse, Coldwater Creek building in Ponderay.
Okay.
We spent like 10 days shooting in that place, making it look like a dystopian company building. Mm-hmm. Anywhere to downtown Coeur d'Alene, which is where we're from, to backwoods areas, lots of forest sequences. Just try to utilize the amazing Pacific Northwest area that we live in, that we were, Rylan and I both were born and raised here, or I'm raised here, Rylan was born and raised here, so.
Yeah. Okay, the old Coldwater Creek building.
Yeah.
I'm gonna watch for that. Any other local, places that I might have stuck my head into that I should look out for?
It's a good question. I mean, honestly, the Coldwater Creek building is the main one. We shot about, I want to say, like a fourth of the entire movie there. Every single nook and cranny inside and a few shots outside as well. Mm-hmm. It was good fun. It was also a bit of an exhausting part of our life. But looking back, it was good fun.
Mm-hmm. There might be some parts in downtown Coeur d'Alene, too, if you find yourself down there as well, that you would recognize. I think that's part of the fun, too, for all the locals who come and watch the movie, is by the end of the movie, or even during the screening, I often watch people, like, pointing up at the screen and be like, hey, look, I know that guy, or I know where that is. So there's some spots. I mean, certainly the exteriors, everything outside, we're showcasing some of the mountains and the trees and stuff that still makes us feel like we're in the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. Not as specific and fun, but definitely gives you the vibe still of the area.
Yeah. Let's see. I'm going to say let's talk about the cast a little bit.
Yeah.
The biggest name in the cast, probably Eric Roberts,
which is
quite a get. I always love when Eric Roberts shows up in a movie.
Yeah. No, he's great.
That's cool. But there's some familiar faces in this. And then I think you mentioned that there's some not so familiar faces or some local talent as well.
Yeah. So I want to say, like, the ratio of local to non-local people in the cast and crew, it's like, I want to say maybe 90% local people. And then we did bring a few out-of-towners in, Eric Roberts being the most notable or one of the more notable people. But yeah, our main actress, our lead actress, Roslyn Luke, she's from Spokane. Our another lead is from Oregon. But then the vast majority of people are just Sandpoint, Idaho, Spokane, Washington folks who just kind of came together and made this is a very community driven film. We would not have been able to succeed in anything we were trying to do without the giant support of all the local people who came out.
Yeah.
But yeah, Brian, did you want to talk a little bit about some of the non-local people that we worked with?
Yeah, sure. Eric Roberts is always a fun person to talk about because people recognize him. So he was, I mean, the role that I recognized him in first was Maroni in The Dark Knight, if you remember, which was always was fun, too. Once we got him on set, we got to ask him a couple of inside questions about what was it like working with Chris Nolan and Christian Bale and getting on that just one of the greatest movies ever, honestly. But Eric Roberts was—he was a really cool guy. He's such a legend in the actor business in Hollywood, and he just loved to come on set and play around and sit and watch. Which you never know what you're gonna get. You get some actors that kind of come in for only their scene and they go back to their trailer and hide away. And Eric was a dude who he didn't even really want to be in his trailer. He was there the minute he showed up on set. And he just wanted to sit behind monitor and watch everybody move around and enjoy the vibes.
Which was flattering and nerve-wracking at the same time.
Yeah, I suppose. Know,
he was our highest caliber person, arguably. And we have him just hanging out. And we're like, oh, don't mess up, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, good fun.
I also had the, personally, I had the job of, no spoilers, but I had to tie him to a chair with a rope.
Uh-huh.
And that was just like, very scary for me to force him to be literally tied to a chair so he can't move his arms for like an hour and a half. And I was like, oh God, please don't hate me for doing this. But he was cool with it. He was like, yeah, that's how it goes. If I have to be tied, I'll be, just won't use the bathroom for an hour and a half. So,
how do you get, okay, you didn't go, you decided you wanted to make a movie, but you didn't rather than up and move to LA and try and get into the, you know, get into the system, you brought Hollywood to you. But how does that go about? How do you get talent, you know, especially recognizable talent from movies and TV to come up here to film a sci-fi movie in Sandpoint and Ponderé and Coeur d'Alene?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you hit it right on the head as far as, like I mentioned, we were raised here. This is our stomping grounds and we didn't want to leave if we didn't have to, you know? We've been making little short films and commercials and freelance stuff here all our life. And so when it came to our biggest project yet, which is Recollection, we were like, what can we actually do something this large a scale in our backyard, so to speak? And I'd like to think the answer was yes. You know, the audience will tell us if we really succeeded or not. But yeah, reaching out to people like Eric Roberts, or we have Cesar Garcia, who's from Breaking Bad fame. He was in one of the Fast and Furious movies and Better Call Saul. These are people that we've either connected to at a local Spokane Comic-Con and thought they were really cool, and then hit their agent up later, snuck into their DMs. or with Eric Roberts, it was a kind of a connection through a connection mixed with the cold call, and then gave him a script that hopefully he would connect with. And it turns out he really took to the material and said yes based off that. So that's more or less how we reach out to our cast. And of course, all the local people we reach out to on a more personal level, because we've been, chances are, working with them and know them personally for years and years already.
Yeah. Anybody that we might have seen on, you know, local screens or local stages at all? Any names you want to
There's a couple. Charles Fletcher is one of the big ones. He's a local actor, I think, in Spokane. But it's funny, we actually, Caden and I just went to an escape room the other day in Spokane, and he's like,
our NASA captain or something.
That's right. He ended up being in the very beginning. They give you like an intro video, and then there he was.
Nice.
So he's a local actor. He's doing all sorts of things and stage plays as well,
commercial work, and you can see him people like Stephen Morton, who's one of our lead actors, who's an awesome, I think he's a Liberty Lake-based actor. He shows up on a primetime television commercials all the time. We're like, hey, look at that.
Yeah.
All sorts of, you know, local people that are, you know, just hardworking people getting their commercial gigs and their short film gigs, managed to rope them into this.
Yeah. We're in conversation, by the way, with Caden and Rylan Butera, directors, co-writers, and the composer, a director, a composer, and both of them writers of the movie Recollection, which is at the Panda Theater tonight, Thursday night, February 19th. And what question was I about to ask you? What came first here? Was it the idea for the movie? Was it just the idea we want to make a movie and we want it to be local? What was the kind of the process of how this all came together?
Yeah, that's a great question. Ryan, did you want to take that?
Or? Yeah, sure. I know. So we've been making short films our whole life and doing creative and narrative storytelling. And then we finally got to a point where you're never fully ready, but we're like, you know what? I think we should try our hand at the big one. So then Kate and I got together in a room, and then we start working on a screenplay, which is always the tricky part, starting from scratch on nothing. So, but after a couple of conversations around and thought about, like, what type of genre can we do as an indie film that's not going to have big monsters and explosions, we realized the story that we could tell at an indie level. And we thought that a cerebral concept like deleting your memories is something that feels really large of scope, but it's something that you can still handle in a human story that at a personal level. So that was kind of the concept that we landed on that we thought was really interesting and invited lots of just interesting questions about humanity and conflict at hands and disagreements about whether or not I would want to delete my memories or whether or not I would want to keep it. And so I think that idea propelled us forward into the screenplay, and we focused on that and on the human part of it. And then we kind of got the local crew we've been working with for so long together, and we made it happen.
And to the dismay of maybe some of our producers, we did end up getting some explosions and some harder things in there. We can't help ourselves.
That is true.
We set out to make something very indie friendly, and then we, of course, like, oh, wouldn't it be really cool though if we flipped a car? And so next thing you know, we do have a few fun little sequences of spectacle as well, if you're a fan of that stuff. But yeah, like Rylan's saying, you can triple down on things that are cheap, which is character work and philosophical moral questions, and those things don't cost anything. It just costs some time and putting some good thought into it. And that's where we really try to put most of our eggs in this movie basket, so to speak.
Yeah. Let's talk about those special effects. Is this mostly 21st century filmmaking, or did you do some practical? When you flip a car, do you actually flip a car, or do you?
Heck yeah, we did. Yeah. All right. So it's
practical effects.
We have lots of cool practical effects. I shouldn't say lots. Like Ryan's saying, it is more a cerebral driven thriller. Yeah. But we do have the occasional fun hand to hand choreography. We've got some fun. Some explosions.
Some gun squibs with, explosions off of bullets being fired.
Nice. So when it came to the car flip, it is essentially we got a crane attached to a really, really cheap car that was the cheapest you could get, and then put a little the hook underneath it, and then, you know, 3, 2, 1, pulled it up, and then timed it with a light gag and a big burst of, like, fake debris, and then with the context, basically we're implying that a grenade blew up the car and caused it to flip over.
Yeah, with a real fire explosion that we did, a controlled blast of, I can't remember what material we ended up using, but we did have, like, a controlled explosion with a fire bang at the same time.
And fortunately, that's not just Rylan and I dinking around in our backyard. We fortunately were connected to some really legitimate stunt choreographers and FX people. The late and great Jerry Buxbaum was on our movie as our FX coordinator, who unfortunately passed away shortly after the the film's release. But big shout out to him for getting some awesome shots in the can and keeping everyone safe while doing it.
Yeah. Was it compared? Well, I guess you don't have a lot of experience to fall back on to say. I was going to say compared to filming elsewhere. You know, does filming in an area without a major filmmaking industry, you know, present challenges? Was it? Was it difficult to work? You know, through local permits and stuff like that, or was this?
It was kind of the opposite experience, actually.
Yeah.
For working in a small town where filmmaking isn't happening as often, we've found a lot of support from the locals. Local companies that came out and provided us with free food sometimes and provided us with their space for free. Mm-hmm. They were incredibly accommodating, and you were able to do things for a lot cheaper and... which was just so awesome. And because of that, we were able to make the movie what it was. The challenge sometimes is finding enough people just to help staff everything. So especially when it came to the background extras, we were so thankful for everybody who came out. And we ended up getting still a good 30 people or so for just one shot to come show up for a whole day, sit around and eat whatever we've got, crackers, cookies, no expense more than that. And those people are honestly the unsung heroes. Like it really adds up to making it feel like we're in a world where there's a big thriving company and people hustling and bustling, moving around in a city. So it requires everybody. It really does. But I think it was doable. It was for sure.
Is it explicitly set in the, you know, kind of in this Northwest, or is it set elsewhere and just happens to be filmed here?
It's not explicitly stated where story really takes place. We kind of wanted to set it in a place where it could be anywhere. Mm-hmm. So if someone's watching it in Colorado, they could be like, hey, this could be right next to where I live.
Yeah.
Or it could be specifically where we did shoot it. We never specifically kind of lay that out just to make it more accessible and relatable. So the hope with something like this is people can watch this movie, hopefully, fingers crossed, they think it's not half bad and go, hey, this area is a place that can actually support some productions and it looks good and it looks cinematic and look at the amazing vistas and Pacific Northwest backdrops we have here. Let's get some more movies here. You know, that's our dream.
I've thought that for a long time. It's kind of stunning that nobody does film. You know, you never see films here. I guess Train Dreams
is
that's movie,
right.
And that is set in the area, but I don't think filmed.
Yeah,
all that much
you're right on that one. Train Dreams, incredible accomplishment, up for 4 Academy Awards this year. And it's an Idaho story. It was actually set in historical Bonner's Ferry, if I recall. And they shot it almost entirely in Washington.
Yeah.
And not villainizing them, like they got it together and made an incredible film. But it does, as a local Idahoan, make me feel a little sad. And the unfortunate truth is, Idaho currently doesn't have the infrastructure for film that Washington or our neighboring states do because of just the film tax incentive, things like that. But we are, fingers crossed, working on maybe changing that. So it's going to take anyone who wants to change that and who's listening right now to keep that in the back of their mind. Let's make Idaho a state where we can film stuff.
Okay, what's next for the two of you, and for the movie in general? We know it's coming to the Panetta Theater tonight, as a matter of fact, but, you know, are you taking this around to more film festivals? It's been at some, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So the recollection has now been through film festivals for this last year, of which it's taken an award home from every festival we've been in, which is super awesome.
Very nice.
And at this point, we're done with our festival circuit, so it's playing tonight at 7 p.m. at the Panetta, and then soon to streaming. So it's going to be coming around streaming soon. I can't say the specific date yet, but if you want more information, we're on Facebook, Instagram at recollection_movie. You can also find us on recollectionmovie.com. And we're sending out updates. We're sending out emails. If you give us your email, we'll let you know when you can watch it. On streaming, and that would be tremendous help for us in filmmaking in this area.
Yeah, and more than anything, we're just really looking forward to actually being able to share this movie with the people that were, you know, in it. We have so many, well, like Ryan said, 30 plus background extras from the Sandpoint area who's never even seen the movie yet. It's been, you know, stuck on our laptops, on our personal hard drives. Yeah. It's nice to finally be able to share what we've been making. And, yeah, get people excited for maybe making another one, to kind of segue into your next thing is Rylan and I, and all of our main close friends who worked on this movie. Our main dream is to keep making more movies, you know, shocker there. But yeah, we actually kind of like it. It's pretty fun.
Cool.
It's an amazing privilege to get to do something, like this. And, it'd be awesome to keep making more in this area. I would, I don't want to hate on any other place outside of this, but you know, this is where I was raised, and I have my friends here, my family here, and our family was involved in this movie too. And it'd just be a dream to just keep doing more of them.
Cool. Well, thank you. Caden and Rylan Butera, filmmakers. The movie is Recollection. It's at the Panetta Theater tonight. It's
7 p.m. Yeah.
7 p.m. is the movie. Q&A to follow. And you can find them online as well. And if you want to ask them questions, come down to see that and ask them all about it. Thanks so much for being here.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having us.
Well, there we go. How about that? A little George Gershwin for you. And Bird Note will wait for us, I think, for us to have this brief conversation with Melody Puller and Matt Goodrich. What exactly was that? That was an arrangement by Earl Wilde of George Gershwin's I Got Rhythm.
Correct. Okay, so, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Good morning, Melody.
Good morning.
And good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
And good morning to you again, Jim.
Good to be here, Jack. All I could think of while listening to that piece of music is the flourish of fingers just moving all over the keyboard. I mean,
Earl Wilde was a blur.
A blur. Yeah. It must have been a blur to watch those.
Earl Wilde was an incredible virtuoso of the 20th century, one of the most famous pianists. And that piece will be performed this weekend if the audience wants to hear it live.
Ooh, well, we'll talk about where, when, and let's do that now. Where and when and what's going on?
At the Music Conservatory of Sandpoint on February 22nd at 2 p.m. This Sunday, we are hosting a free concert given by Dr. Roger McVeigh and Dr. Giselle Hillier, who are coming from the University of Idaho to present this program and also to offer a masterclass to our students.
Okay. Now, any charge?
No charge, but donations are accepted.
Perfect. And where is the Music Conservatory located?
It is on 110 Main, here, right here in Sandpoint.
The old fire department.
That's
correct.
Right.
Hmm. And it's a great venue. The Little Carnegie is, I guess, where it's going to be in the big room. Okay.
Where the fire engines used to be.
Used to be. And this is 2 to 3 this Sunday, violin and piano.
Correct. Well, the first half will feature Roger McVeigh on piano, and then the second half will be the Prokofiev Violin Concerto, and he will be playing the orchestral part for his wife.
Perfect. Perfect. And who's the audience? Is this something children would enjoy? Is there an age appropriate?
Oh, it would be great for all ages. And it's just a great opportunity to get exposed to some amazing performing.
Tell us more about the performers themselves. They're coming up from Moscow. Both of them are college instructors?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Dr. Roger McVeigh is the chair of the piano department at the University of Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife, Giselle, teaches violin there also. She's a violin professor.
So the first hour from 2 to 3, both of them will not be playing together. It'll be piano first and then violin for the second half?
Yes.
Okay. So the second half, they play together.
Oh, they play together. Yeah. Okay, that's what I was getting at.
Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful. And then the string master class, that is 3:15 to 5 o'clock, an hour and 45 minutes on Sunday. Can you talk more about that?
Well, there's two master classes going to be happening simultaneously, because after the violin and piano performance, the violins will go to a master class upstairs, and then the pianists will stay in Little Carnegie for a master class with Dr. McVeigh. So it's really a two-in-one.
Okay. And what's a master class? What is involved in a master class? Do I walk in not a master and exit a master? Or
that's the hope.
It's actually, I have my students asking me this question, what's a master class? Mm-hmm. And I say, well, it's a chance for a student to perform like they're playing in a concert, but then they also have a lesson in front of an audience. So we curate... we have five students who will be playing in the piano master class, and the public is welcome to watch the class. They get to watch the teacher work with the students.
Ah, so you'll have violin upstairs, piano downstairs. What, five students each with each upstairs and downstairs?
About that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and students are learning from the masters themselves, and then you have people in the audience who are watching this process?
Yes.
And they're really fun because
usually
we have really luminaries in their field, and they're often really quotable. Like, they give stories about their career and their experience with the piece that the student is playing. And usually they're of really good humor. Melody and I have both played in many master classes where we've written down fun things.
And I've been in the hot seat. I'm performing in master classes, and then I've also been an observer. And the observer part is the place where you really learn a lot.
Okay.
Because when you're in the hot seat, sometimes you forget what's going on.
and does one have to be a student to observe? And I think it would be just fun to see how one learns.
Yes, it is. It's a great place, even if you don't know anything about piano or violin, to go in and see how it works.
And what age students will be there performing in each? What's the age range?
I'm not sure about the strings, but I think that they could start as low as 10 years old, maybe. And we have up to a senior in high school. Mm-hmm. So, certainly the spectrum of teendom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if there's anybody out there in the listening audience who has a young person who is learning piano and or violin, this is a good chance to just sit back and watch other people learn.
Even if they're a flute player or a kazoo player or whatever, they can still learn something from
there you go.
From it.
I just think how does one learn a violin? How does one learn a piano? I think that'd be fascinating. Mm-hmm. So this is at the Music Conservatory this Sunday. And both of them will go for an hour and 45 minutes?
So the concert itself is probably under an hour, actually.
Under an hour, right.
And then we're going to have a little bit of downtime in between. And
sure,
then, sure. And then the master class is an hour to an hour and a half.
Well, okay. Let's see. How did this event come together? Did you guys reach out to them? Did they reach out to you?
They actually reached out to us,
yeah.
Which was... Quite an honor.
That's nice. Late last summer.
Yeah.
So. And cool. we knew them because we were down in the University of Idaho playing. And and Roger is very big in Idaho Music Teachers Association and has heard our students. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just such a neat thing that he's coming up to the top of the state to work with our students. And we look forward to meeting Giselle as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys have a relationship with the university as well? Is there any kind of formal relationship, or you just, everybody knows?
It's a developing relationship, actually.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yes. That's cool. And we like to encourage our students who attend the conservatory to check out the University of Idaho. And so we're honored that they're coming up here to check us out.
We have two good, former alumni who are down there. Right now, just starting out, loving it.
Good.
So it's great to have that pipeline.
So how often does the Music Conservatory present a program like this?
This is unique, actually. This is the first time that we've had our University of Idaho guests come up for this. A couple of years ago, we had a professor from WSU, Washington State University, come up and give a beautiful program, Fabio Menchetti, who is a piano professor there. But it's nice to develop these relationships with academic institutions.
Mm-hmm. Each department likes to give a couple master classes every year with kind of our kind of circle of good teacher friends. But this is a nice special addition to that.
Now, if one is interested in learning more about this, is there a website one can go to find out this information?
I believe so. I believe we have the information on the Music Conservatory website, which is
sandpointconservatory.org on the events page.
Okay. Is that where you printed off these?
Why, yes, it is.
Okay. And these are very detailed descriptions of not only the concert from 2 to 3 p.m. this Sunday, but also the string master class and the piano master class and lots of information. So you can go online.
Is there anything you'd like to mention about the specific pieces that they're going to be performing? Any information you have about it? It's okay. I'm putting you on the spot here. I'm not sure.
The Prokofiev Violin Concerto in the second half is an incredible piece of music, and not often heard. So you're going to love that. The Rogers concert in the first half is very interesting. It's all transcriptions. So all pieces like the Gershwin that you played that existed in another form, mostly songs that other piano and pianist composers turned into virtuosic piano works. And that seems to be the through line of his concert.
So in other words, the music that we heard by Gershwin is not the way that he created it? Is that what you're saying? Originally, it was a song.
How Gershwin created it?
Right. That would Gershwin had this in mind when he created the song?
Yeah, not at all.
Okay.
So Gershwin wrote the song, and then the wonderful Earl Wilde took it into a piano piece. And then we have that with Rachmaninoff doing the song The Daisies. They'll be playing that. And ending with a piece that you can't miss. It's Horowitz's arrangement of themes from the opera Carmen. Ooh. It's an amazing
That'll be a treat.
Tour de force.
Oh, what fun. What fun. And want to emphasize, concerts are free.
Correct.
Free. So that if you have a Sunday afternoon open and available this Sunday, the 22nd, the Music Conservatory is the place to be. 2 to 3 is the concert, and then 3:15 to 5, the two master classes, one upstairs and one downstairs. And obviously, the downstairs one is the piano because they're not lugging it upstairs.
Melody Puller and Matt Goodrich, I see your name is elsewhere on the upcoming events page for the Sandpoint Conservatory. Will you guys be performing at all? Will you be part of the master class, or you just get to watch this?
We just get to watch the master class.
Cool.
Nice. But do you want to tease what you're doing next month?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We are starting to celebrate the 250th anniversary of our country's birth. And we plan to give a program of music by all American composers. And it's going to be quite a variety.
And it happens to be on Melody's birthday.
That's Friday, March.
Birthday of the country and a birthday of Melody.
That's right.
Whoa.
So on March 20th, you'll be doing that. Is Friday, March 20th?
Yes.
That's correct.
The two of you together?
The two of us.
Okay. Also in Little Carnegie with a kind of train theme.
And the time?
7 p.m.
Mm-hmm. 7 p.m. at the Little Carnegie, the 20th. What's sort of nice about February and March this year is that they're both the same. And I can look at the February calendar and say the 20th of March is a Friday,
nice.
7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
But more important, this Sunday, 2 to 3, the concert, violin and piano, and then two master classes right afterwards.
Anything else that we should mention about these events coming up before we sign off, get back to our regularly scheduled program?
Free.
Yes, free. And thank you so much for having us on the show today.
Rarely we go beyond 9 o'clock, but we are fluid, if anything.
What a nice surprise to have an additional guest today.
It just shows the cultural offerings in our town. And go see the movie tonight, everybody. For sure.
And then also tomorrow night at the Panada, POAC is doing Abby Posner in concert, and that's at 7 o'clock. So busy, busy, busy weekend.
I will mention one or two other things coming up. I believe it's tonight the ongoing Winter Carnival continues. I believe tonight over at the museum, the Historical Society and Museum, they're hosting their brand new exhibit should be up, and they are hosting an open house. I think that starts at 4:30, so you can go.
Do you know what their brand new exhibit is?
Let's see.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, Jack, but you brought it up.
I know. No, I don't.
Okay. Go there and be surprised.
That's right. It's Toasty Fest at the Granary District. It's a winter carnival event. Toasty Mobile Saunas will be at the Granary tonight. that's right. And you can also go to that movie Recollection. That's tonight at the Panada Theater at 7 o'clock p.m. So lots going on this week
and
tonight.
Friday is Abby Posner, and then Sunday.
Yes, Abby Posner. That's right.
And then Sunday is the Music Conservatory in the afternoon. So
it seems like things are picking up in town. It was kind of a nothing quiet like, month or so, but
nothing
now,
like snow.
Yeah,
to us. Okay. Want to thank both of you for coming in, and we appreciate you keeping KRFY on your schedule, and anything in the future, just give us enough time and we'd love to have you back.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
You bet.